Welcome, everyone. This is meeting 16 of our Quran reading group, which started several months ago. And I am really pleased to welcome this evening Robert Spencer. He's the director of Jihad Watch, which is a program of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. And I will let you go ahead and read a lot of his bio on Jihad Watch itself. You click in the upper left and it says about Robert Spencer. But just know that he is the author of 10 books, of which I'm in awe, including two New York Times bestsellers. One is called The Truth About Muhammad. I'm holding it in my hands right now. And there's also The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam, which we've got somewhere in the other room. Bosch, as you guys all know, has been reading about Islam. He's read the Quran and read a number of Spencer's books over the years. And, of course, he's the one who recommended me to Spencer in the first place on the site, and that's how I got the idea to use his commentary, the Quran commentary that's on the site, as a basis for helping us understand the Quran in this group. So thank you very much, Robert, for joining us today. I'm very, very pleased to have you. Are you there?
Thanks.
Okay, great. Now, just to let you know about this group, what happened was, I think you're familiar with Anne Barnhart.
Yes.
So back several months ago, she put out the video in support of the Quran burning pastor. His name was Terry something. Is that right? I forget his name.
Terry Jerome.
And she said, no, of course we should be allowed to discuss this book and burn it if we think it's evil, etc. And she proved it by going online, and she had a two-part video. And at the end, she gives out her home address and says, you know, come and find. And I just thought, she is the bravest woman in the entire world. So I was inspired. I said, okay, we have to read this book for ourselves. Took a little poll on Facebook. There were a number of people interested, so we put together this group. And using the internet and this wonderful platform that I found, we've been able to communicate every week and talk about it. And it's, I think, been a good thing. My purpose personally in reading it was to try to understand what a significant number of Muslims believe Islam requires of them, and to try to figure out whether these people pose a danger to me personally. And so I wanted to, you know, to look and just try to get a sense for myself. I understand that there's more than just the Quran and the bit of commentary that we've read, that we could really become experts on this by reading the rest of your work and probably a lot of the hadiths and everything else. But I'm trying to get a sense of what the average, intelligent, concerned American should know about this ideology, and also be capable of spreading some of the basics about it to other people, because I feel that a lot of people in the country are being hoodwinked right now into thinking that this is a great peaceful ideology when it isn't. So that's my general purpose. There's people in the group who have different angles of study themselves, and that'll be reflected in some of the questions. So that's a bit of background. Did you have any more questions about the group and our purposes, or no?
No, I think it's great. I'm glad you're doing it. I wish every American were doing it.
Well, and that's the hope, is that maybe we'll get more people started along this path as well. And of course, each of us have different contexts in which we are talking about what we're doing to other people. And so I think that it's, you know, the purpose is going to be served. And as I said, if we, you know, put this podcast out there as well, it's going to help. So with that said, are you ready to go?
Absolutely.
Okay. Now I have one participant, and we'll just call him Mr. B. He asks a very fundamental question, and he is concerned with studying Islam and comparing it to other religions. So he asks, what is the most fundamental philosophical, theological characteristic of Quranic Islam that distinguishes it from New Testament Christianity?
I suppose the immediate answer to that, the most obvious answer to that, is monotheism. Of course, Christianity, New Testament Christianity, is monotheistic, but contains the idea of the Trinity, which the Quran decisively rejects and repeatedly says, chapter 19, verse 35 is one place, and there are many others, it repeatedly says that Jesus is not the Son of God. It rejects the Trinity, although it misunderstands it, and says in chapter 5, verse 114, or 116, we're right around there anyway, that that at the end of the world, Allah will call Jesus and ask him, did you tell your followers to take yourself and your mother as gods alongside me? And Jesus says, no, of course, I didn't say anything like that at all. And so the idea is that Jesus, Allah, and Mary are the Trinity, at least in the Quranic view, and it's decisively rejected. As a matter of fact, the Quran tells Christians, don't say three, cease, it will be better for you. And there is the fundamental idea in Islamic theology, based on these Quranic passages, mm-hmm. that the idea of the Christian Trinity is not monotheistic, but actually violates the idea that there's one God, and that there can't be three gods and one God, and so on and so on. Now, that, of course, is highly debatable, but the fundamental idea of the Quran, as opposed to New Testament Christianity, is exactly that, that there is one God, one person, no Trinity, no Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, no incarnation, no salvation in the cross of Christ, none of that.
Okay. Now, in terms of a philosophical approach, do you have any sense of what would make Islam fundamentally different from New Testament Christianity?
Philosophical approach, yeah. In the philosophical sphere, you have in Christianity, pretty much all across the board, Catholic, Orthodox, Protestant, you have the idea that the world makes sense, that God is good, and if God is good, then he orders the universe according to consistent and observable laws, mm-hmm. because the good is the truth. The truth is one. Goodness is one. It doesn't take different forms, and so it doesn't contradict itself either. Whereas in Islam, there is no idea of that, which is generally termed natural theology. There's no idea that there could be any that you could even say that God. There's no idea that you could even say that God is good, because that would be to limit God's power and his sovereignty. And so everything he does is good, but what he does doesn't have to be consistent. And this is why science developed in a Christian context in Europe and not in the Islamic world. Although there were Islamic philosophers, the influential early ones were generally ruled heretics. And they didn't have their successors and followers didn't have the kind of influence that they had.
Right.
I'm talking about people like Averroes and Avicenna. Mm-hmm. And so you don't have really any kind of philosophical foundation in Islam that allows for the development of science or the development of a natural theology. You have instead simply that everything is fiat. Everything is the way it is because Allah says it is the way it is. And to assume that it's going to be that way in the future because he is consistent would be to limit him unduly. And to assume that it is the way it is because there is some underlying rhyme or reason behind it is also to limit him. He is absolutely beyond and absolutely sovereign, and thus there is no basis for philosophical speculation or investigation in Islam.
Right. Now, I also noticed in some of the Quran that we have already read, there's just about 40 pages in the Dawood translation towards the end that we haven't finished yet. And I noticed that it says that once you call yourself a Muslim, you are not supposed to question anything or debate about anything, right?
It's 101. Yeah. Very interesting passage. It says that you're not supposed to question because some people have lost their faith by questioning. And that's very different from the New Testament idea, since the original question here that we're considering has to do with the New Testament. I can point out that that the New Testament says that the Christians should be always ready to make a defense of their faith. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the Quran, in chapter 5, verse 101, it says, believers don't ask questions about things which, if they were made plain to you, they might cause you trouble. But it tells them if they ask questions while the Quran is being revealed, then they'll get answers, which, of course, is something not available to Muslims outside the time of Muhammad. But it's also very interesting as an indication of the way in which Muhammad got revelations. He was apparently listening to the people around him and not simply getting this pipeline to Allah, as is stated in Islamic tradition.
Right. And that brings up one of the things to me that is just, you know, so damning to the religion itself, is when you read the Quran, there is so much that seems to be revealed for the convenience of Muhammad. So, for example, I would not have expected to read in a religious text something about the etiquette of visiting the prophet at his house and saying, don't show up too early unless you get permission, and don't stay too long after dinner because you will annoy the prophet. And while the prophet doesn't, you know, he's not eager to tell you that you annoy him, Allah is happy to tell you that you annoy him, something like that. I can't quote it chapter and verse.
You got it quite right. That is the tenor of the passage. And yes, you're right. It's not the kind of thing you would expect to be in the perfect and eternal book that has existed forever in paradise with Allah. And so you really have two choices when confronted with a passage like that.
Right.
One is that Allah, that the guy is a con man who is making up revelations from Allah to suit his own convenience. And he doesn't like people bothering him all the time. And so he has his God say, don't bother the prophet, don't barge in on his house, make an appointment to see him if you've got to see him, and so on. Mm-hmm. But the other alternative is that this is somebody who is so important to the supreme creator and God of the universe that a good deal of the book that he has had forever with him in paradise is about this guy's comfort and convenience. And that's one of the reasons why Muhammad has such a central place in Islamic theology and tradition.
Right. And people have to decide which of those two they believe. I tend to believe the former, of course. And to me, the most horrific example in the entire text is the one that requires four witnesses in order to prove adultery. And I mean, to me, again, that seemed to be put in for the convenience of Muhammad so that his wife would be free of the charges of adultery, right? I mean, that's, I think, the background to it. We need more than just the Quran to show that that's the case, though, right? We need something from the Hadith. Is that right?
Yes. The whole story actually comes from the Hadith. The Quran in chapter 24, verse 4 and 24, verse 13 tells people that you have to have four witnesses to establish the crime of adultery.
Right.
But there is no indication in the text of the story behind it. There's a long story behind it in the Hadith about how Aisha was left alone during the a caravan ride and was brought to the Muslims who were in the caravan by a Muslim warrior who happened upon her by accident in the desert. And they were immediately, because they were alone together, thus accused of adultery.
Of course.
And Muhammad was about to allow her to be stoned to death, but he was very fond of her. And so finally he got a revelation explaining that she had to be exonerated because they didn't have four witnesses
right. That
saw the act. Now, this is very problematic for Muslim women ever after, because there have to be four witnesses who even establish the crime of rape. And, of course, that hardly ever happens. And so it makes it very difficult to establish such a crime. And in many cases, for example, in Pakistan, the problem with this law is that it makes for the imprisonment of women who are actually the victims of rape, because their testimony is inadmissible in such cases, and they don't have the four witnesses. And so if they're pregnant, then this is evidence that they themselves have committed adultery, and they are actually, it's better if they're imprisoned, because they could be stoned to death in that case.
Now, is it only the pregnancy that would be the evidence, or would it also be the fact, I mean, that they're in effect admitting adultery by coming forth and accusing someone of rape?
Yeah, exactly. And so that can be, it makes it very problematic,
right,
and virtually impossible,
yeah,
for a woman to get any kind of justice in that situation.
Yeah.
And
so,
see, but this, yeah.
I was just going to say, while there's other revelations in there that seem like they're for the convenience of Muhammad and we might laugh at them, to me that's the one that is the most horrific, because it does seem like it's for his convenience in a certain way, and it has caused tremendous suffering for women thereafter.
Precisely.
Yeah.
It's for his convenience, but it inconveniences every other woman in the Islamic world.
Yeah.
And it's extraordinarily disadvantageous, as are many things, to women in the Quran. But what's notable about it, I think, most of all, is that the Quran is essentially inexplicable, taken by itself. Mm-hmm. It's completely disconnected. You know, people are always accusing me of taking the Quran out of context, when anybody who's actually read the Quran knows the Quran doesn't really have any context. The Quran is one of the most disembodied books you can ever read. It's got it floats from topic to topic without any explanation. It rarely explains the reason why it's saying what it's saying, or the setting in which what is being said is being said. It just has all this disembodied religious exhortation and denunciation, and it's the hadith that fill it all in. And this, of course, actually has given rise, because the hadith are actually quite late and collected several hundred years after the Quran. Some people, some scholars speculate that the Quran actually was referring to other things altogether, of which we have no record, and that these stories in Islamic tradition, like this one about Aisha that we've just been discussing, were actually concocted in order to make sense of a Quranic text that the Muslims found to be completely opaque.
Hmm. So it might be even worse. It might be even worse than we thought.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Now, you have a book that's coming out next year, and it's Did Muhammad Exist, right?
Yeah.
Now, I'm not going to ask you to reveal the punchline unless you want to. But one thing that occurred to me is, you know, in reading this, I started to wonder whether Muhammad himself actually believed in God. Because
That's an interesting question. That actually, when you have somebody who's such a clear opportunist and who represents himself as getting messages from God, then I think it does raise the legitimate question as to whether he himself believed there was really a God who was speaking to him, or did not really, or was just somebody who was manipulating the credulity of the people around him. Certainly the self-serving aspect of the revelations does lend credence to the latter view.
I mean, I guess he could have told himself a story that God would be happy that he was recruiting more people to be good or fight in his cause or whatever. So he could have told himself a story as well. But I did wonder, and I was thinking, you know, does he even actually believe in God, or does he just have this good racket going? Now, I have questions from our group here, from Mr. J. Here's his question. He says, what do the millions of non-militant Muslims think while reading the Quran? He says, the Quran clearly and repeatedly calls for attacks on Jews, Christians, apostates, unbelievers, which, you know, he classifies himself as an atheist. And he says, also, there's taqiyya and the jizya, the tax, the degradation of women, the lack of respect for reason. And he wonders what the non-militant Muslims, the better Muslims, would be thinking when they read this. Do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, they're probably not thinking anything, because they're reciting it in Arabic. And most Muslims today are not Arabs, and they don't speak Arabic. And even Arabic-speaking Muslims speak generally modern standard Arabic, or some variation thereof, Egyptian, Lebanese, whatever. But they don't speak 7th-century classical Arabic. And so, in Islam, the Arabic character of the Quran is essential to it. You're not reciting Quran in the mosque if you go to pray your 5 prayers a day, and there's a little piece in the prayers where you recite a bit of the Quran. And you don't do that in any other language but Arabic. It's not the Quran if you do not recite it in Arabic.
Okay.
And so that means that you have millions and millions of Muslims in Indonesia, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in Iran, in Nigeria, and all these other places that don't speak Arabic, and they are reciting syllables in Arabic that they don't necessarily have any idea what the meaning of them is. And so it's no surprise at all that they would not have any, they wouldn't be confronted with all the things that you enumerated in your question in the way that somebody like you, who is a non-Muslim reading a translation, is.
Right.
For them, this is a ceremonial thing, and they don't necessarily have any direct encounter with the actual meaning of the text at all.
And they're not supposed to read a translation, right? So wouldn't even occur to them, let me just go out and get a translation in my own language and try to get some sense of this, right?
There's not a high priority put on it. It's not forbidden, at least in some places. What's forbidden is to make a translation and to pass it off as the Quran. But of course, for purposes of dawah, of proselytizing, Muslims do make translations, and they generally represent them as the meaning of the Quran. You mentioned you were reading Dawood, and Dawood was not a Muslim, and so his translation is called just the Quran. But if you get a translation written by a Muslim, like Muhammad Marmaduke Pickthall or Abdullah Yusuf Ali, which are the two main translations in English right now, mm-hmm. they both are called the meaning of the glorious Quran or something of that kind. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is that they do not encapsulate the actual Quran itself. They do not contain it, because once it's not in Arabic, it ain't the Quran. But they do give the meaning of it. Now, I remember a Pakistani Muslim told me, in all seriousness, a few years back, he said to me, I am very proud of my religion, and I have read almost the entire Quran. One day, I plan to get one of those translations and find out what it means.
And oh my gosh.
He was serious. It was just something he intended to do one day. But it isn't something that he was given in school in Pakistan, where the premium was just on memorizing it. Because the Arabic is the words of God. And you memorize that, and you're able to recite that, then you're in good shape. To understand it, that's secondary.
So there's a lot of people who call themselves Muslim but don't really know what this book contains. And so they're reciting things that by rote, just in terms of the sound. What do they think the religion contains then?
They think that it contains sort of the popular civic religion that is the kind of ideas that people have of religion in every society, you know, that it means that you should serve God, love God, be nice to other people. And if you meet Muslims from Somalia or Pakistan who are not very well educated, and I'm speaking from personal experience here, they act as if being nice to people is something that Islam invented and gave to the world, and only Muslims really understand what it means. And they don't realize that these are sort of general human concepts. And they think that's the essence of the religion.
Well,
and a lot of times you get these people, when they hear people like us talking about the violent passages or the oppressive passages in the Quran, and they think we're lying. And it's not that they're practicing taqiyya. They actually do think we're lying, because they have no idea those things are in there.
So we've got an uphill battle if we're going to try to educate people about this, right?
Well, we just have to be aware that not every Muslim who says that we're lying when we're telling the plain truth about what's in the Quran is necessarily lying himself.
Right.
And he might.
Yeah. Then
but he might not.
Then there's many out there then who would say that, yes, they're Muslim, but they're peaceful people, and they're right, because they don't really know what what the doctrine contains.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Here's a question. It's more specific, and this is it's about chapter 52, verse 24. It's on page 370 of Dawood, and there's all these descriptions. We've enjoyed all the descriptions of paradise throughout the Quran, and there's little embellishments of the different things that paradise contains. So in this chapter it says, "Fruits we shall give them, and such meats as they desire. They will pass from hand to hand a cup, inspiring no idle talk." So this is the wine that doesn't make you drunk, and it won't inspire a sinful urge in you, it says. And then it says, "And there shall wait on them young boys of their own, as fair as virgin pearls," end quote. So the question is this a hat tip at all to homosexuality?
Yeah.
Because in the commentary, we read your commentary on this part, and we didn't see anything in there about that.
Well, it's sort of oblique. I mean, see, the problem is that the women, the Huris, are very clearly identified as being something that exists there for the pleasures of the people in paradise. But it doesn't say that about these boys.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there, it's clearly understood that way by in much of the popular religion. You know, I remember a few years back, this Taliban fighter in Afghanistan being interviewed on CNN, and he said something about how he thought that it was a win-win proposition, because if he won on Earth, then they would establish the perfect Sharia state in Afghanistan, and if he lost and was killed, then he would enjoy the boys in paradise. And so he didn't have any compunction about that. But it varies. Of course, it's a little bit different kind of situation the farther west you move. But certainly in Islam, in the Islamic world, there's a tremendous tolerance for male homosexuality. Not for female homosexuality at all. But for male homosexuality, it is considered to be something that, as long as you're married and you're having children, then what you do with other men is not sinful as such. It's only if you are not married and not having children that it becomes problematic. But that's more of a cultural view, not really founded in the Quran itself.
So when... go ahead.
I could ask, sorry. Yeah. This is Bosch. I knew Robert. And also, if it's a romantic relationship, it's even worse. Homosexuals.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So when you hear about homosexuals being either stoned or hung, are these the non-married ones? They aren't having children? Is that what happens?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
Those are people who declare themselves to be homosexual and who are known as such and who are not pursuing getting married and having children. Those are the guys that are going to get in trouble in a place like Iran.
Okay.
And also, they have a tradition in Afghanistan. I think they're called the Ashnas, the young boys that the men have on the sides, on the side. And the Taliban, I think, banned it.
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah, the Ashnas.
Yeah.
I remember it.
Now,
very fond.
I myself just hypothesize that the attraction of this for them might be because of what little they think of women in that culture. They think women aren't anywhere near their equal, and so then therefore men become that much more attractive to them. I don't know if that's true per se, but it was also true in some of the early Greek culture as well, where, you know, with some exceptions, women weren't thought of as highly as men. So you could understand why you would be romantically attracted to a man, because you'd want someone who was more your equal. The young boys, I don't know exactly, but okay, so that's more of a specific. Let's go to a general question again. Mr. D, as we'll call him, asks, do you think with full intellectual and scholastic integrity that it is possible to interpret Islam in a peaceful way, or does anyone who believes that commit intellectual dishonesty of some kind?
I don't think that you can take the Quran at face value and be a peaceful Muslim. I think that you either have to reject literalism in some way and say that the text does not mean what it appears to mean and has to be reinterpreted. And that might be theoretically possible. But most of the people who proclaim themselves to be moderate Muslims, who find that the true Islam is teaching peace and not warfare against unbelievers, they're either ignorant or dishonest. I don't know how that can be avoided when you have so many passages involving killing the unbeliever and so on. And people say, well, those passages have no validity for nowadays. They were only for Muhammad's time. And that actually is completely the opposite of mainstream Islamic theology, which holds that the passages that are bellicose have more validity, are valid for all time, and cancel out passages that are less belligerent. And so they must know this if they have any education in Islam. I find it very hard to believe that people who say that they, you know, like Ed Hussein, the famous Quilliam Foundation so-called Muslim reformer in England, mm-hmm. and he says that he was in a jihad group and was with Al-Qaeda or whatever, and later on he woke up and realized that the real Islam is peaceful. And he doesn't ever explain how it is that he read the Quran and figured out that it's peaceful. And I think that is the big thing that's always lacking from these people's explanation of Islam, as that is, how exactly do they understand all these passages that are not peaceful? And they never bother to explain that.
Right. Now, how...
Also, if you don't mind, if I just say one thing?
Oh, sure.
Uh-huh. And how about, you know, Muhammad's violent history? That's part of it all, to the point where it was spread through violence. It was spread through... So even if they try to interpret it a certain way, well, the founder of Islam was a violent man. He had a violent history. Doesn't that...
Yeah, certainly. Any, yeah. You can say from the very beginning of Islam, you have people understanding it as meaning that they should wage hot warfare against unbelievers. Right. And so it's hard to argue with that, that the people who were closest to Muhammad, the people who knew Muhammad, like Abu Bakr and Umar and Uthman, the first three caliphs, as well as Muawiyah, for that matter, the fifth caliph, and Ali, the fourth, they all understood Islam to mean warfare against unbelievers, jihad to mean warfare against unbelievers. So why that would be something that they all got wrong is never explained by these so-called moderates.
Right.
And, right, and he would be considered the personification of Islam, necessarily Muhammad, wouldn't he, to most Muslims, the way they understand Islam. That's all.
Yeah.
Precisely.
Well, and moreover, there are explicit passages in the Quran that say Muhammad is someone to emulate, right? So that would...
Oh, definitely, yes. So, Muhammad is the supreme model of emulation. As a matter of fact, it's very... His status is even higher for Muslims than Moses for Jews or Jesus for Christians, even though Christians understand Jesus to be the Son of God and the God become man and so on. It's still very different from the Islamic idea that really everything Muhammad does is right. In the book of Exodus, I believe it is, Moses kills an Egyptian, and it is never presented that because he killed the Egyptian, it is acceptable to kill people you don't like in a fit of temper.
Mm-hmm.
Moses is judged by the moral law. Everything in the Old and New Testaments is subject to the absolute laws of the commandments. But in Islam, Muhammad is the equivalent of the commandments. What he does is right and is the index for right behavior.
In general, then, given all of the evidence that's stacked against it, what is your, you know, personal optimism for a moderate form of, you know, Islam gaining in the mainstream, that it's actually going to become accepted and practiced widely?
I think that's wildly unlikely. I would never say it's impossible, mm-hmm. because all sorts of things have happened in history that people would never have been able to predict. But that's really a... theoretical distinction. As far as looking at the Islamic world, looking at the nature of how Muslims understand the Quran, the nature of how they have interpreted its various passages over the centuries, I don't see any possibility for that kind of reform. I wish I did, but I think that we have to be honest about it. There are all sorts of people like Zuni Jasser, whom I've debated, and so on, who are insisting that the Quran and Islam are really peaceful, but they don't have large followings, and it's unlikely that they're going to develop large followings given their complete departure from mainstream Islamic tradition. It would be like somebody showing up in a Christian church, any kind of Christian church, and saying that... I represent the true Christianity that actually has five gods, and we're going to now call you all to this authentic Christianity. It's unlikely that he would find a whole lot of support in any church, and it's the same kind of thing that Zuni Jasser confronts when he speaks to Muslims about his version of Islam.
Well, here's the thing that I was thinking. So here we are. There's a number of Muslims in the United States, perhaps... the majority of them would fall into the category that we were talking about earlier, where they aren't really familiar with the doctrine themselves. They have this idealistic idea of what the religion contains, and then they see someone like a Zuni Jasser, whoever it's going to be, who wants to be a leader of this moderate form of Islam, and they follow it. Maybe in some place like the United States, where we have freedom of religion and where that won't be stamped out, maybe it has a chance of succeeding, do you think?
Well, it's got a chance of succeeding among non-Muslims, I think. It's got a chance of... it's just like with Zuni himself, who's far more popular with non-Muslims than he is with Muslims. And so, you know, non-Muslims are always avid to find the latest moderate, the latest peaceful adherent of Islam, because it's reassuring to them, and they think, well, things aren't as bad as they seem now. Everything is okay. That's something that's it's very different when you go to Muslims and you're trying to deal with them about a different form of Islam. Then it's a lot less popular.
Right. So, it's like Irshad Manji when she says that Islam has returned to its clever, fun-loving roots. I mean, that's just, it's unbelievable that she would actually say it and get away with it. But
yeah.
She does.
But see, you know, it's only non-Muslims that fall for that sort of nonsense.
Right. But
Islam was never clever or fun-loving, and they're much closer to, I mean, Muslims know, that is, much closer to Khomeini's statement that there is no fun in Islam.
So is the idea that even though maybe individual Muslims themselves aren't aware of the contents of the doctrine, that they would reject following someone like Azudi Jasser because they're authoritarian in nature, so that they're just going to stick with tradition for the sake of tradition, and they'll follow a particular imam even if they aren't necessarily fully aware of what that imam is preaching?
Because remember, we talked about it at the beginning. Yeah. Don't question.
Right.
And so they might not understand any of this. They might think that Islam is just all about being nice, but they're not going to break ranks.
Okay.
Because you're told not to question. You're told to follow these authorities. And that is very firmly reinforced, because you get killed if you don't follow them.
Right. So it seems that we've got a bit of a challenge. What would you advise people in terms of dealing with the political threat of Islam? I mean, I guess backing moderate Muslims isn't going to get us very far. What do you see?
Our whole political future, our whole life, our whole societal future is based on moderate Muslims right now. We're assuming that all the Muslims we're bringing into the United States are moderate and are peaceful and are going to remain that way, and that their children are going to be moderate and peaceful. We're assuming that all the Islamic countries that we are pouring money into, like Pakistan, are moderate and peaceful and are going to remain that way. Our entire foreign and domestic policy depends to a tremendous degree on the existence of moderate Muslims and moderate Islam. I think that it's going to be the occasion for a rude awakening. And there are going to be many, many more incidents like we've already seen with the Muslims in Somalia coming to Minneapolis, and then waging jihad in Somalia for Minneapolis, and going back and forth and recruiting in mosques in Minneapolis for jihad in Somalia. It's not going to be a big step before they're recruiting for jihad in the United States. And we're going to start to reap what we've sown here, and to pay the price for our naivete and willful blindness on these issues.
So what is your recommendation then? As far as I know, there is a huge amount of enthusiasm around a candidate, Perry, who himself, you know, from reading some of the material on your site recently, he himself is perhaps sympathetic to Islam. He's probably deluded into thinking that there's this peaceful version that he might be helping to promote. I don't know. What would you recommend?
Well, obviously, you know, since you refer to it, that I don't have high hopes for Perry. I don't have a whole lot of respect for Perry. And actually, this all started out in a very innocuous way because of some things that I discovered about Perry's connections to Grover Norquist, the Republican Party heavyweight player who is very close to Islamic supremacists and unsavory individuals and groups. And Perry is very close to him, closer than other candidates are. Mm-hmm. And some things that my colleague Pamela Geller discovered about his curriculum in Texas that he oversaw with the Aga Khan, the head of the Ismaili Muslims, and that curriculum is a very benign picture, very whitewashed picture of Islam. And we started to publicize these things, and I've really been dismayed at the frenzy and fury of the reaction from people who were at one time on our side.
Right.
And were our friends. But I've never seen anything like this. You know, I've criticized Romney, I've criticized Herman Cain, I've criticized other candidates over the years for their myopia and willful blindness about Islamic Jihad activity, and never have I seen the kind of furious reaction that I've seen from the Perry people, and it makes me suspicious about what's really going on here, and who's got the fix in so that you can't say anything about this Perry. But it makes me less confident than ever that he knows anything about the jihad threat or will do anything serious or necessary about it.
So your idea would be, let's educate people, first of all, about what this religion contains in its doctrine, right?
Oh, yeah. In the first place, the ignorance is abysmal and universal. And the kinds of things we're discussing right now about Islam and the Quran, even though they're manifestly and obviously true, they would get us charges of hate, of bigotry, of Islamophobia. And even without a hearing, without an examination, we would be dismissed and condemned. And nobody wants to know about these things. Nobody wants to hear them. But they are, the truth is the truth. And I think they will ultimately out. But right now, the biggest thing, the biggest problem we face is this willful blindness and unwillingness to discuss the problem itself.
And of course, if we educate people about the doctrine, the other thing that we need to do is be able to educate people about a candidate like Perry and what his connections might be. One thing that had concerned me about him was that I read he signed into law a halal regulation that would require the judge who applies this, you know, regulation to a particular case to interpret Islamic doctrine or rely upon some Islamic expert. I assume that that's a concern of yours as well, that there's been a little bit of creep of Sharia in our courtrooms, yes?
Very much so, yeah. As a matter of fact, Sharia has been a deliberative factor in cases in 23 states now. And so it's not just a small thing. And of course, the most egregious case was the one that was most well publicized, where a judge in New Jersey refused to charge a Muslim husband with sexual assault on his wife because Islam forbids a woman to refuse a man at any time. And so he was essentially bringing Sharia into this New Jersey court. That was overturned. But there have been many other cases in which Islamic law has been introduced into American courts. We have to be aware of this and aware of how different it is from constitutional law, and be prepared to defend constitutional law and defend the freedoms and the rights that are given to us in this society, because they are very much threatened.
Right. Now, I've got a question here that's typed in on the spur of the moment. It says, have the violent terrorist types of Muslims, have they read the Quran, or are they just following orders?
Well, it depends on who you mean, you know. I mean, I'm sure some of them have read it and some of them are just following orders. Mm-hmm. But as I've shown at Jihad Watch over the years, the jihad terrorists are the ones who, if you read their material, they consistently refer to Quran. They're always quoting chapter and verse, mm-hmm. and explaining what they do on the basis of the Quran. And so they're making the case within the Islamic world. They're making the case to Muslims that if they want to be authentic Muslims and follow the Quran, they have to do what they're doing. That is, they have to join up with the jihad groups, or at least approve of what they're doing. And this is a challenge, really, to the self-proclaimed moderates, that they need to try to reclaim the narrative from the jihadis. But they have made no attempt to do so up to this point.
Now, in your opinion, when they do cite these passages, are they always doing so correctly, or do you think that they are perhaps misinterpreting some of the passages and using it as an excuse for violence?
Well, there are broad-based claims from moderate Muslim leaders that they are misusing the passages. But here again, this misuse is never explained. And it's hard to see how one could see a passage that says, slay the unbelievers wherever you find them, mm-hmm. as meaning anything other than slay the unbelievers wherever you find them, and to be able to charge somebody who is slaying the unbelievers wherever he finds them with misunderstanding the passage. I think that would be a very hard case to make, and that's one of the reasons why the so-called moderates don't attempt to make that case.
Right. Now, what about the people who say, well, the context of that was that Muhammad was badly treated in Mecca? You know, they threatened him, they kicked him out. And so the only reason that he was violent was because they were first violent to him. And so that's the context for all of this.
Yeah, you know, it's funny to me how often I hear that, as if that's some sort of mitigating statement, when actually that makes things even worse, because the claim from Islamic jihadis nowadays is that they are only reacting to American and Israeli atrocities. And so because we were violent to them, they're being violent to us. So in other words, if one understands that as being the true understanding of these violent passages of the Quran, then that's exactly how the Islamic jihadis are interpreting them and using them nowadays to justify violence against Americans and Israelis.
Because they're saying we started it in some way. There were things that we were guilty of, so we helped us.
Yeah, I know most of it is trumped up, but the point is that if you say that violence is justifiable against those who attack you, then that's exactly what they're saying. That's exactly what they're doing now. And so it doesn't really get us out of this religion-based violence, this idea that they're waging war for God when they fight against us.
Right. So, for example, one of the specific questions I have here is, in chapter 17, verse 32, about there, because Dawood isn't very specific about which verse is what, it says, "You shall not kill any man whom God has forbidden you to kill, except for just cause." And so then, of course, the question is, what is just cause, right?
Yeah, exactly. You notice all the caveats that in the Ten Commandments, it says, "Thou shalt not kill." But this says, "You shalt not kill anybody that Allah has not forbidden you to kill, except for just cause." So you can even kill people that Allah has forbidden you to kill if you've got just cause.
Right.
And so the general understanding of that passage is that you can perfectly well kill unbelievers if you're waging jihad against them in order to spread Islamic law further in throughout the world. And you can even kill Muslims if it is necessary to do so in order to further the aims of that same jihad.
So even Muslims could be killed for that purpose. Yeah,
and so see, that's killing somebody who is you've forbidden to kill, but you're doing it for just cause.
Can I just say something also about the self-defense arguments that people make? You know, when they cut heads off, that's not self-defense. When he cuts 600 to 900 heads off of the Jewish tribe, the Quraysh, that's not self-defense. That's mass murder. That's genocide. That's, you know, it's I mean, you can't make a peaceful man otherwise do these things unless you already had it in him to do it.
Precisely.
Right. Now, we always hear how poetic the Quran is, right? And of course, that's one of the things that's supposed to make it miraculous, because Muhammad himself was said to be illiterate, although I read your commentary on that the idea that he's actually illiterate was probably a mistranslation of the term. But here's a question for you. You know Arabic, correct? You understand it?
Yeah, I ain't that good at it, but I know some, yeah.
Does in Arabic, does it sound poetic? Does it sound beautiful?
Yes.
It does, okay.
Oh, yeah, sure. Oh, yeah. It very much does. It's quite mesmerizing, in fact, in some passages. Of course, it varies. When you get to some of the real legal instructions in, like, the Cow, Surah 2, and some of the other passages that are laying down laws for, like, consanguinity or things like that, Chapter 5 and elsewhere, then it's the poetic power lags. But there's a lot of internal rhymes in Arabic, and a lot of rhyming just naturally.
Okay.
And so especially some of the earlier surahs, that is the chronologically earlier ones, the brief and arresting, vivid ones that are toward the end of the book as it's arranged, they're very they're remarkable to hear, really, in some cases. And I think that has a great deal to do with the general idea that this is a book from God, that Muslims hear this and they think that a book with this kind of cadence and this kind of sonority and this kind of rhyme scheme, it all has a gravitas to it that other things don't have. Of course, the Quran challenges people to produce a surah like it, and people have taken up that challenge. You can go to surahlikeit.com and hear Quranic-style Arabic for Christian tracts. And so it's not as if that it's really unique or inimitable, but poetic, certainly.
Now, there's a lot of sort of things that we see change chronologically throughout the Quran. So, for example, my impression has been that in the beginning, you see Muhammad giving sort of timid warnings. In fact, maybe in some of the earlier ones, he's speaking more as, well, I want to do this because I don't want to anger Allah. And then maybe as time goes on, he's giving more of the types of warnings that you should do this because you don't want to anger Allah and have the fires burned and the boiling water and the eating from the horrible tree that's going to make you sick. And right, you know, so he's describing to them what would happen to them. And then in the later surahs, chronologically, then he's saying that not only will Allah do horrible things to you in the afterlife, that things might happen to you now, and in fact Allah might tell me that I have to help carry out some of these things. So there's that evolution.
Very much so. The Quran presents Muslims in the later ones, as you say, there's an evolution. In the later chapters, the Muslims are the executors of Allah's wrath, mm-hmm. and the disobedient, the rebels, the people who make war against Allah and His Messenger, it's up to the Muslims to enforce their punishment in this life. They have to be made to suffer in this life as well as in the next.
Right.
And that's the job of the Muslims.
And you noticed that evolution as well, where, I mean, because after reading this for so many weeks, and yes, it's episodic and it's sometimes painful and boring, but, you know, I have this picture in my mind of Muhammad, and you could see him at first when he's just very timidly trying to spread this in the early days, not, you know, going out there and saying horrible things will happen to you. And then, you know, like I said, the last part of the evolution is horrible things will happen to you. And in fact, Allah is telling me that I have to carry some of those out. So I see that. The other thing I saw was that it seems Muhammad himself is of increasing importance personally as time goes on. And then later we get those etiquette rules and those things. But I was going to ask you also, does it get more poetic? It gets less poetic, okay.
Yeah, it gets to be much more discursive, much more prosaic, much more leaden, less arresting, okay. Less electric in the rhyming, in the imagery. It's really the evolution of somebody from going from being an itinerant preacher and being on the outs, trying to get people to believe in him, to becoming the leader of a community. And as the leader of the community, no longer just being on the outside looking in and issuing these dark warnings, but actually having to legislate, having to rule. And so he can't take the kind of tone that he took before.
Right. No, and that is what I saw. So not as good a poet as time went on.
No. Yeah, or maybe he just, he couldn't. It's hard to, you know, it's easy to make I don't know how easy it is. I've never done it. But to make some sort of poem about the impending judgment, the afterlife,
right.
The doom that is yours, if you reject Allah, that's one thing. But then you have to settle down and say, okay, well, in this community, you can marry you can marry an unrelated woman, but you can't marry your mother or your sister or your aunt. It's hard to make a poem about that, I think. It's a little less capturing of the imagination.
Right. Now, one more specific question here. Do you see Islam as rejecting monasticism? The institution?
Oh, yeah.
You do, okay.
Oh, yeah. Islam rejects monasticism in the Quran itself. And there is no monasticism in Islam at all.
Now, I seem to remember, because I think we just read the passage in the last couple weeks. It might be 5727, which is what this questioner cites, but it might be different. I just remembered some qualification about, you know, the Christians who had practiced monasticism had made some sort of mistake. And so it maybe left it open that if you had done it properly, then it might be acceptable in Islam. That's not true?
Well, there are some passages that are not so unequivocally rejecting. But okay. Yeah, 5727 says they invented monasticism, the Christians, and we did not ordain it for them. And so that's pretty unequivocal. And even worse is right around 930, 931, where the Quran says that they take their monks and their rabbis, that is the Jews and the Christians, as gods besides Allah. And there's a hadith where somebody says they don't worship their monks. And he says, yeah, they do what they say. They obey them. And so that's the same thing.
Right. Okay. Now, we have just a few minutes, so a couple questions. If you were telling us there are certain passages within the Quran that we should know, master, be able to actually cite chapter and verse, memorize, what would you say are the top five?
Chapter 9, verse 29, mm-hmm. about making war against Jews and Christians until they submit and pay the jizya, the tax. Mm-hmm. 434, beat a disobedient woman. Let's see, 9.5, 4.89 and 2.191, which is slay the pagans or the polytheists or the mushrikeen, wherever you find them. Mushrikeen are those who commit shirk, which is the worst sin in Islam, which is associating partners with Allah, that is really worshiping anybody besides Allah. Mm-hmm. And that is repeated three times in the Quran, to kill them wherever you find them. The unbelievers are the most vile of created beings, chapter 98, verse 6. The beheading passages, 47.4 and 8.12. 47.4 is when you meet the unbelievers in battle, strike at their necks. And 8.12 has the angels actually cutting off the heads and the fingertips of the enemies of Allah. Mm-hmm. 5.33, which calls for the crucifixion and or the amputation of the hands and foot on opposite sides of those who make war against Allah and his messenger. There are many others, but those are just a few off the top of my head that are good to know because they give a lie to the religion of peace business, and it's good to have them at one's ready when challenged.
Right. And then be able to go out and educate people. Now, in addition to this, I was thinking in my mind it would be important to have memorized the passage in which it says we should emulate Muhammad and then know a few key facts that are undisputed about the history of Muhammad and the things that he did.
Yeah.
So, for example, he executed hundreds of Jews from that tribe that he lived with in Medina. Is that correct?
Yeah, and he married the 9-year-old when he was 54.
Right.
Actually, he married her when he was 51 and she was 6, and then consummated the marriage when he was 54 and she was 9. So, yeah, that's 33:21. Chapter 33, verse 21 is Muhammad is the excellent example of conduct.
Right.
And you also might note that in chapter 60, verse 4, Abraham is called the excellent example of conduct, but there's a caveat that does not give, it's not given with Muhammad. In 60, verse 4, it says that Abraham is the excellent example of conduct when he says to his father, who was a pagan and a polytheist, that there's enmity and hatred between me and you forever because you don't worship Allah.
Right.
And then it goes on to say that he's not Uswa Hasana, he's not an excellent example of conduct when he says to his father that he'll pray for him. And so the Quran is actually saying you should imitate Abraham when he hates the unbelievers, even in his own family, but not when he is kind to them.
Right. And there's several examples of that I've seen where religion is, you know, thicker than blood, so to speak. Because,
oh yeah, very much so.
Yeah. And we
and
saw
also 48:29, that's a good one to know. Chapter 48, verse 29 is Muhammad is the apostle of Allah. Those who follow him are merciful to one another, but ruthless to the unbelievers.
Right.
And that distinction, of course, runs all through Islam. So that's also good to have.
Excellent. And in terms of our study going forward, what would you recommend doing next? So again, most of us have only just read the Dawood translation and the corresponding commentary that you have posted there at Jihad Watch.
Well, you mean in terms of continuing to read the Quran?
Or reading some outside sources that we could use to shore up our knowledge. And, for instance, something about the life of Muhammad. So, of course, you actually have the whole book. The Truth About Muhammad might be a good place to go next, right?
Yeah, if you would pardon the self-promotion, I think that knowing about the Quran and the high points of the life of Muhammad, as I have them in the biography, that is a very good thing to know.
Yeah, and then we'd be intellectually armed enough to be able to at least question strongly this, education out there that Islam is the religion of peace.
Yeah, very much so. And so it's not just solely self-promotion. I could recommend the Life of Muhammad by Alfred Guillaume, which is a translation of the Sirat Rasulullah, the biography of the Messenger of Allah by Ibn Ishaq, Muhammad's first biographer. Okay. And that was one of the main sources for my biography. And so you have in my biography a combination of that with Ibn Sa'd, another early biographer of Muhammad, and a lot of material from the Hadith. But in the actual Ibn Ishaq book, as rendered by Alfred Guillaume, you get much more. And it's wild stuff, I tell you. So I recommend that highly.
Okay, excellent. That's very good. Now, does anybody else have any questions? Because I think we've covered the waterfront and we've reached an hour here. Okay, I don't see anything. I thank you so much, Robert, for joining us and taking time out of your day. And as I said, all of us are going to do our best to pass what we know on and try to fight for our culture.
Thank you very much.
Thank
it's
you.
Been a pleasure.
Have a good
Thanks
evening.
Thanks a lot, Robert.
Bye-bye.
Bye.